My goodness, I'm speaking today on what appears to be the eve of our 250th anniversary as a nation, when the Declaration of Independence took some brave ideas and incorporated them into the concept, not the first time in human history, but in the most amazing way, the idea of a republic. Whether you're looking right now at this website because you're in therapy, or that you're thinking about the idea of counseling or psychotherapy, you are certainly aware of the complex times and in many ways the uncivil war we're living through, which is only slightly less violent, it would appear, in its own way, than our original Civil War in 1860. It's certainly war, disease, addiction, economic hardship, and perhaps the most profound of these impact from these toxic variables are the process of disillusionment. We seem to be extraordinarily stunned and disillusioned and discouraged, in the midst of, again, continued affluence and power and dominance as a culture. So these are the challenges. I'm aware, and most of you are who would be listening to this, are aware of the pandemic rates of suicide among the elderly and the young, particularly in the later stages of adolescence, that the suicide rates seem inexplicable and growing in their lethality. We are told that we have a mental health problem, and we are encouraged passionately to seek therapy, to seek treatment, that there is a mental health crisis that we need to emerge from, and that it is threatening the very foundations of our civilization. And so counselors and therapists are being recruited as the primary antidote to this crisis. I guess I'd like to, from a position of being a therapist, to maybe disquiet some of that sense of urgency a little bit. That civilization has always wrestled with pain. And they've also wrestled, despite the incredible, relentless decades of technological and scientific improvement, we wrestled essentially with the same problems. That human beings have had problems in their interpersonal relationships. They've had problems with accepting their mortality. They've had problems with their insecurities, whatever they might be. And we've had to wrestle with the persistent levels of injustice that we encounter in the world. And we experience these painful consequences among the wonderful kindness of human beings, the elevating generosity and good humor and sacrificial instincts of many people. And so this pattern of inconsistency remains in our culture. One of the things that, if you ever heard my talk or see this or on the website as you listen to this, there was a book that greatly moved me. It was written in 1970. It was called The Pursuit of Loneliness, American Culture at the Breaking Point, was the subtitle, by a gentleman named Philip Slater. It won the Pulitzer Prize, and it was a brilliant book. And it was a very fascinating thesis. The thesis wasn't simply that human beings are suffering from loneliness, but that we are a culture in active, aggressive pursuit of loneliness. Why would we do that? why would we isolate ourselves and invite all of the toxins that kind of come to that? And so we begin to wrestle with that. That why in a culture of such affluence is there such persistent pain that comes from alienation and isolation and loneliness? Okay. So there are two energies that seem to have emerged since I first did my talk, The Ten Contaminants, back in 2013. And those two energies I would describe as progressivism and the instinct towards exploring sanctity. These emerge, these two themes really emerge as I would say, part three of the monumental, maybe the most monumental revolution in human history called the Enlightenment. You know, that was when people like Francis Bacon and Descartes and others engineered into a time this belief that human progress measured by intellect and scientific advancement could solve the ills of the world to such a degree that we could create a kind of heaven on earth, a utopia. And people who believed in God and people who didn't, who were agnostic, even atheist, had that sense of hope. The Enlightenment must have been a remarkable time to be alive. But of course, the Enlightenment ultimately ended, you know, with the carnage of the 20th century, much before that, but the 20th century would be responsible for over 200 million, I can't even comprehend that number, over 200 million deaths in which, you know, human beings were oppressed, enslaved, tortured, victims of one type of Holocaust or another. And then we emerged shortly after that into wars like Korea and Vietnam, and after a quieting of some of the pain and trauma of the World War II era, we entered into the second part of this Enlightenment, and we became further alienated as over 55,000 Americans were killed in Vietnam, you know, and the remarkable experience where we won every battle but lost the war, a war that we could not define, that was unwinnable and designed to be unwinnable. And so now, here we are in 2026, and the forces of progressivism, redefined, repackaged, but containing many of the historical elements, remains. And there is a challenge between that forces that we would be generally inclined to say are left of the political spectrum and forces that are in the right of the political spectrum. Okay. And, you know, in 2013, I distilled from my readings and experiences in therapy 10 toxins, or what I call contaminants. Okay. The first I deemed isolation. Isolation led ultimately, naturally, inevitably, to an element in our culture that became preoccupied with the pursuit of power. On the political spectrum, the left turned to Marxism in particular, and the idea that by distributing wealth and emphasizing not equality but equity, we could create and craft a culture and a society that could be maintained by people who had elite intellectual and academic credentials, that the basic desire to build a culture upon family and upon interpersonal relationships and community needed to be demythologized, in their words and in their terms, and that that there would be a new attempt at a utopia. This is really, I think, from historical perspectives, the third leg of this Enlightenment. And I would argue, without any more potential for good than the first two have shown. In fact, the consequences might even be, if possible, even greater than the 200 million lives that were lost, that our very existence could be threatened by that. Okay. But at the same time, it's not all dark and it's not all bleak, because I believe that we're also looking at part three of the Great Awakening, and that there is a Judeo-Christian renewal that's exciting, and that people are turning once again to the power of meaning, that the formulas for success and contentment aren't really there. And we're looking, I hope, beyond just the simple desire to respond to the pursuit of pleasure and to find the where can we be anchored in the things that ultimately mean most, that bring us not necessarily adrenaline rushes, but bring us authentic joy in the midst of our triumphs in life, in beautiful moments, but paradoxically exists even in our times of suffering, that there is a groundedness and a perspective, and that the many people, particularly younger people as I talk, are, you know, being moved by these issues and recognizing that there's a kind of bankruptcy out there. So, you know, and there's, it's important. So, you know, what's emerging in the midst of this is an incredibly new and powerful technology that we, like many other technologies that have been unleashed in human societies going back to the Industrial Revolution, we have a new concept called AI, artificial intelligence, that seems to be capable of turning virtually every aspect of human existence on its head, that creating vistas that have been unexplored, that promises to assimilate a kind of collective wisdom and specific wisdom that will far transcend the greatest minds in human history and will allow us to address virtually all of the things that are difficult and laborious in our human existence. AI is terrifying to many and exhilarating to others. And how we kind of wrestle with that paradox is, you know, is important. In addition to AI, we also have the recognition of how to chemically address our brain. And so while drugs like cannabis have been legalized and the use of drugs certainly, you know, is being explored by more and more and kind of normalized, now there's become a renewed fascination, which I first became aware of way back in the ancient 1970s, but with a fascination with LSD. But now psychotropic drugs are being mixed with psychedelic drugs in order to address things like PTSD and psychosis and schizophrenia. And its advocates talk about, you know, all the the incredibly positive, powerful, potentially curative experiences, that those things come, okay? So, again, excitement, human technology. But human technology has created, at the same time we know, weapons of mass destruction. As recently as 2020, we watched, you know, scientific zealots unleashing a virus that killed how many people from the COVID virus, altered lives, altered our culture in many ways, in many profound ways. So it is equally elusive that we find a balance between faith and science, that this false dichotomy still exists, that despite Western faith being the cornerstone of the scientific method, many have pitted one against the other, reason against ancient wisdom. And, of course, that's really not true. So I'd like to focus just for a minute on kind of a renewal of an old idea, maybe a kind of back to the future in some way. I'd like to take the title of artificial intelligence and think about it as not artificial, but authentic inspiration. What is authentic inspiration? What has moved the human mind and human souls through the years? And how can we renew our interest in this authentic inspiration? What can we do? So I'd like to talk just for a few minutes about those themes with you.